Normally in this class, we have our introduction to the Old Testament is what we've been studying in this class. And if you've noticed, which if you haven't noticed, then we'll talk later, that VBS is happening. And so in the spirit of introductions, we will be doing an introduction to our VBS themes, our VBS theme this morning. So an introduction to what our VBS is about, our theme and that kind of stuff will be taking place this morning. You've seen the signage, you've seen the advertisements, Discovering Bible Lands. And, you know, it's quasi an homage to a certain adventure. But when we think about the Bible, all these events that take place, they take place in all these different cities and countries and regions that we read about. Most of them names we can't pronounce, some of them we don't remember, but there are some big ones that stand out in the Bible, some places that were rather important in the story of the Bible. And so we're going to be looking at some things that occurred in these different places. The lands that these events took place in really molded and shaped a lot of what we see in the Old and New Testaments, the cultures that were there, and the people, even the topography, everything played a part in what we read in the Bible. So we're looking at discovering Bible lands as our theme and for our classes. And so the first Bible land that we'll be looking at is Egypt. I realize that you might not be able to read that and see the details on it, but what I want you to understand, just to see, this is an image of Egypt about the time that Moses would have been involved in Egypt, and these are the lands that they had conquered, the lands that they were reigning over. Can y'all actually see a pointer? If I flash a pointer up there, can y'all see it? Okay, I never can. People do all this, and I'm like, I don't even know what you're doing. But all right, hey, awesome. So this right here, if we look at Egypt, just what is the main thing that really shapes and molds the land of Egypt? Denial. It ain't just a river in Egypt, right? So we have this river, obviously, and you know, if we have the lower and upper Egypt. But right, I want you to remember this. Right here is the river, Egyptian river, and we go all the way up here to the river of like the Euphrates and the rivers of the Syrians and all that. Remember this strip of land. Remember the strip of land. We'll come back to that later on. But what did we call this? When you studied geography and that kind of stuff and ancient civilizations, do you remember in school what we called this whole area? This whole area right here. The Fertile Crescent, yes. You remember. I'm so proud of you. Why is this great and this not so much? Sand, desert, things don't really grow, right? So this is the Fertile Crescent. We have Egypt here, and this played a big part in the history of the Hebrew people. When we first see Egypt, and we read about Egypt in Genesis chapter 12, verse 10. Genesis chapter 12 is sort of a big chapter, thematic-wise, for the Old Testament, for Genesis. What happened in Genesis chapter 12 that you remember? The first few verses, we have some promises that were made. Do you remember? Yeah, a covenant was made with Abraham and God, and in those first few verses. Verse 10, what does verse 10 say about Abraham and Egypt? This is an open book. Yeah. Famine. There's a famine. What does Abraham have to do? Go to Egypt. What does Egypt have built into its topography that would kind of help protect it from most famines? Water. A river. Yes. Is this the only time that people sought refuge in Egypt because of famine? No, it's not. And we're alluding to something that's going to be happening later on, right? And so here we see Egypt comes onto the scene because of a famine. And also, when we look at Egypt and becomes sort of this birthplace for a nation as they go to Egypt. In Genesis chapter 15, verses 13 through 18. If I can find 13. And God said to Abraham, "Know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed for 400 years, but I will also judge the nation whom they will serve, and after they will come out with many possessions. As for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You will be buried in a good old age. Then in the fourth generation they will return here, for the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete." And it came about, so here we see this sort of this language that is being made. And again, God reaffirms the covenant that's made. In verse 18, "On that day the Lord made a covenant with Abraham, saying, 'To your descendants I have given this land from the river Egypt as far as the great river Euphrates.'" Do you remember we said, remember that land, the river Egypt to the great river Euphrates. When they first go in and start conquering, God said, I've given you all this land. I mean, all this land. When they first start going in and conquering, do you remember how well that went? They did all right. I mean, okay, it's one thing for me to, it's Monday morning quarterback talking here, right? But they went in and conquered. God said, "I've given you all this land." But they went in and they still had trouble. Like, it was, well, I'm getting ahead of myself, but there were certain pockets and places that they didn't really even ever get rid of all the people out of there. Not until much later did that really, really happen. So what's interesting is that God has said, "This is all yours. You just got to go in and take it." And sometimes we fall short of what God has even promised us. God has blessed us, you know, more abundantly than we understand, and God says, "You just need to be obedient and go in and do this, and this is yours," but we fall short. That never happens, right? That never happens anymore. That's just, but anyway, so in this case, Egypt was going to be this sort of birthplace, and, you know, years, hundreds of years before it even happens, it's being prophesied here that this is going to take place. Now, how did the people get into, how did the people get into Egypt? Joseph, right? Things happen. There are things that happen in your life, I'm sure. You have events that take place. And what's interesting in this scenario, God was had this planned. These things were taking place years, hundreds of years before they were even going to happen. God already had these things set in motion. We can't say, but what's interesting is to think about the providence of God, that there are things that are happening in your life right now that are setting together plans that are going to be unfolding years in advance. Do you ever think about that? God's blessing you right now, and you don't even know it. Joseph was being blessed. He didn't know it. It didn't feel like a blessing. But what happened with Joseph? How did he get into that? He just decided to take a trip to Egypt and say, "This is a great place. I'll just set up a tent here." How did he get into it? He was sold by his brethren, by his brothers. Now, it's one thing for a squabble amongst siblings, right? But it's another thing entirely to sell your brethren, right? I know some of you thought about it, but it's entirely something different to actually do it. But what's interesting, if you look at what took place in this chapter 37, verse 28, what's interesting is something that's mentioned to whom he was sold initially. Look at verse 30, chapter 37, verse 38, or 28 rather. Who was he sold to? "Then some Midianite traders passed by, and they pulled him up and lifted Joseph out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver." Who are the Ishmaelites? We're like distant cousins, right? They were cousins. Ishmaelites were the descendants of Ishmael, which was the son of Abraham through the handmaiden. So here we have, again, all these things that take place keep crossing over. And it's interesting here, he was sold to distant relatives. in this case. And so we go into Egypt, and the story unfolds, and it's more than we have time to talk about as far as how the family eventually gets to Egypt, again because of what? Why were they going to Egypt? What did Joseph, through the dreams, interpreting the dreams of Pharaoh, what was going to be taking place? Famine. 7 years of plenty, 7 years of drought. And here we come in, the family comes in because of this famine. And so they're there, and then they are oppressed, and we have the book of Exodus. Exodus does a little bit with Egypt, right? A little bit takes place there. What are some great things or some neat things that happen in Exodus as you read about Egypt? They left. They exited, right? Probably the best part of that book. I mean, if you like action and adventure, the plagues are pretty cool. If you like the leadership story and a man growing up and coming into power and, you know, that kind of stuff, Moses is a great example of one, an unexpected leader. And so we have those kind of themes in the book of Exodus, all rolled into the setting of Egypt and the things that took place there in Egypt. What happens as they come out of Egypt and they're in the desert? They make the pact with God at Sinai. Is there ever this draw for them to go back to Egypt? Yeah. They complain. I mean, there are, you know, I've heard people complain. But if you could hear the murmur of almost millions of, probably millions of people complaining, I don't know how Moses at one point said, "No, God, don't kill them all." You know, I don't know how he did that. He is a great leader. But in this situation, they were complaining. Look in Joshua chapter 24, and what I want to look at is that a lot of struggle went into keeping Egypt out of the people. The land of Egypt influenced those people immensely, so much so that the first generation that came out of Egypt, did they ever get to go into the promised land? No, they did not. They balked when God brought them over there and said, "All right, here's what you need to do." And the 10 spies came back and said, "No, we're too small. We can't do it." And God said, "All right, fine, you're dead. You're not going in." And so when Joshua, at the end, after most of the conquering had been done, in Joshua chapter 24, verses 14 and 15, a rather famous passage of Scripture, it says, "Now therefore fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and truth, and put away the gods which your fathers served beyond the river and in Egypt, and serve the Lord. If it is disagreeable in your sight to serve the Lord, choose for yourselves today whom you will serve, whether the gods for which your fathers served which were beyond the river, or the gods of the Ammonites in whose land you are living. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." What does he say there about Egypt in verse 14? What is the fear? What is the concern? What is he advising against? The serving the gods. Not only the gods that they're in the land that they now dwell, which is in that comment in and of itself is sort of a slap in the face of those gods, right? You're dwelling in the land of don't serve the gods in the land you now dwell. You just conquered all these guys. You just conquered all of them, and you want to serve them? How effective were they as gods? Not very effective. That was sort of a slap in the face. But the concern was not even that they would serve the gods that are there, but there's still that lingering concern of the influence that Egypt had in serving. What did they do when they first came out and Moses was gone 40 days up on the mountain? What did they start doing? "We need a god to serve." And they just, you know, Aaron's like, "We just threw this gold in and this calf just kind of popped out." You know, and so not what they're supposed to be doing as they're serving God. And so Egypt had an influence. So much so that look in Deuteronomy chapter 15, verse 15. Actually, let's just skip forward. Deuteronomy chapter 24. I'm not even advancing this, am I? Exodus. There we go. Let's look at Deuteronomy chapter 24. But in these passages here, we have the same kind of theme being repeated. It is kind of cool when you get quiet and you can hear pages turning. Just saying, that's kind of fun. All right. Deuteronomy chapter 24, verses 17 through 22. We have this
this construct about justice and not perverting justice. And he says, "You shall not pervert the justice due an alien or an orphan, nor take a widow's garment in pledge, but you shall remember that you were a slave in Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you from there. Therefore, I am commanding you to do this thing. When you reap your harvest in your field and have forgotten the sheaf in the field, you shall not go back and get it. It shall be for the alien or for the orphan or for the widow, in order that the Lord your God may bless you and all the work of your hands. When you beat your olive tree, you shall not go over the boughs again. It shall be for the alien and orphan and for the widow. When you gather the grapes of your vineyard, you shall not go over it again. It shall be for the alien, the orphan, and for the widow. You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt. Therefore, I'm commanding you to do this thing." Several times throughout the book of Deuteronomy, they were told, "Remember that you were a slave in Egypt." Again, the influence in their time spent in Egypt had an influence, or should have a motivating influence on these people. In this case, what is he saying about why should they remember that they were slaves in Egypt in this particular instance? Take care of what? The helpless? Were they ever in a situation where they were helpless? Were they ever in a situation where they needed a redeemer? God blesses us so that in turn we would bless others. God blessed them with redemption, brought them out of that land, and we as a blessed people continue to be a blessing where we are. Here is this being written here in Deuteronomy chapter 24. Before they even go into the promised land, before that even happens, when do we see this actually unfold in a narrative later on in the Bible? When do we see this unfold? In the fields of Boaz? The descendants of Jesus would actually be blessed because of this particular instruction. Obviously, many families will be blessed because of this particular this instruction. But even the Son of God, his descendants, will be blessed because of this particular instruction. Remember Egypt. Don't forget Egypt. And so that is another land that we'll be studying in class on. So now we're looking at... I skipped it, didn't I? No, there it is. Okay, Jericho. This is an ish picture of Jericho. A rather formidable city looking, right? As a city, it's rather large, and it's famous for its walls. It is this big, huge city. When we first see Jericho, again, this is sort of an artist's rendition. If you went and saw the actual site of Jericho right now, it looks like it's a dirt mound, essentially. So this looks more impressive. So I figured I'd save you for the boring pictures. But you see this wall, and you see this sort of low-lying area where they might have marched around it. So this is a berm, and then the wall starts. All right. If you're marching at the base of that thing, or if you come and see this walled city, is it going to be rather kind of daunting, perhaps? Could you see why maybe, I don't know if we can do this. but this is interesting. What's interesting, too, is this commentary down here, which is talking about when they actually found evidence that supports the Bible story. Imagine that. When they actually went down and dug at the level that would have been in that time period, they found burnt wood and like it had been on fire. And you know what they also found? The grain stores were still there. The food stores were still there. Those kind of things were still there. Why would those things still be there? Now, remember, if you're, a conquering nation, and you go in and you steal everybody's hamburgers, that means you have hamburgers for later on, right? But if you leave it there, then you're leaving a lot of work and a lot of wealth just in grain stores and things that are there. What did God say to do with those things? So anyway, we see that the Bible narrative being supported by archaeology. All right, so it is one of the oldest cities, and it dates back way back to where those first civilizations were being made as they come off off the ark. And the Israelites, when we first see Jericho or first read about Jericho, the Israelites are camping on the opposite side. It's this sort of gateway, becomes this gateway into the Promised Land. They're camped in Moab on the opposite side of Jericho. And we see that in Numbers. And as we see about what was in, it's a very affluent city, and we see read about what it has. And when the spies go in Joshua chapter 2, this story takes place, and Rahab helps them escape, and they make this promise to not kill her as she has helped them escape. But there is this king there questioning about it, and she hides them from those individuals. Now, what do we know about the conquest of this city, this particular city? This is, how many cities have they conquered when they come up to the walls of Jericho? How many have they conquered? They cleaned out the Moabites on the one side, but this is the first in that you know, technically the Promised Land area that they're going to be conquering. And then they come in, and there's this big walled city, and we would think, all right, now you need to build siege engines and build ramps and start building these kind of things and battering rams and those kind of things, right? That's what we would think you would need to start building to take down a fortified city. But what does God tell them to do? March. Quietly. Okay, look just real quickly, if you have your books there or your Bibles turned open to Joshua, look at Joshua chapter 2, the last verse of that chapter. Joshua chapter 2, in the last verse, there's a spies talking to Joshua. They said to Joshua, "Surely the Lord has given all the land into our hands. Moreover, all the inhabitants of the land have melted away before us." God was doing some things before they even got in. So when, in a lot of battles that took place in current history, more modern history, you'd have like naval bombardments and that kind of stuff that would soften an area before you'd actually send troops in, right? We're supposed to soften an area before you send troops in. And in this case, God has kind of gone before them and softened the land. He's done a lot of psychological things to kind of soften the land. And the spies are even saying, they're melting before us. They're melting before us. So that's good news, right? And so when they go in, God doesn't say go in with these siege engines and these towers and that kind of stuff. He says go in and march around the city. Now, if you know these people are coming and they're camped out there, there's millions of them, and they're coming in to fight against you, and here they come. Have you ever had that anticipation of something's about to happen that I'm not going to like? Dentist, perhaps? And so you have that, obviously, to a higher degree, and they're waiting, and they come, and they march around the wall once and leave. That wasn't so bad. And they do it 6 more days. And then on the 7th day, something happens, right? They start doing it 7 times. And then on the 7th time, what do? They shout and blow the trumpets, and the walls come down. Not exactly what the Jerichoites, the Jerichoans, would have thought to be the case, right? And so these walls come down because of obedience to God. That takes place. Not exactly what they thought was going to happen, but this land eventually was bestowed to the tribe of Benjamin. What did Joshua say at the end of Joshua chapter 6 about the rebuilding of this city? Would it be a good idea to rebuild this city? Joshua said what? It's going to be cursed. You'll bury your oldest son at the laying of the foundation and your youngest at the raising of the gates. So basically, you're going to lose your kids between the time you start building this and by the time you end or finish the building of this city. You're going to lose your children. So guess what? Later on, somebody decides, I'll try doing that. And guess what? He lost his children in the process of building Jericho, rebuilding Jericho. Later on, we fast forward a lot of years into Herod the Great. We read about him in the opening pages of the New Testament. Herod the Great built a fortress there, and then he died in it. I mean, not the same day, but eventually he did die in the fortress there he had at Jericho. Jesus did several things there in Jericho, and giving sight to the blind. There we read about in various instances of that, or one instance of that in the Gospels. And then what's also interesting, here is this descendant of Rahab, ate with Zacchaeus in Jericho. I think that's interesting. Here is again, things that overlap. A descendant of Rahab is eating with Zacchaeus, Jesus eating with Zacchaeus there in Jericho in Luke chapter 19, verses 1 through 10. And so we see that story unfolds there in the city of Jericho as well. So a lot of history in that city, obviously. The next area we're looking at is Galilee. This is a really a neat way of looking at the Bible lands. So here is the Sea of Galilee, and topographically, it's a lot lower, obviously, than all the surrounding areas. You have Nazareth here, Cana, and so just real quickly, you have Judea. In the time of Jesus, this area was separated into three major areas. Judea, Samaria, and Galilee were the three major areas in the time of Christ that this area was separated into. Back in the day, Solomon actually gave 20 cities from this region to the king of Tyre for payment for when he was building the temple and a lot of other projects. In the time of Jesus, again, these were divided into three different sections about, you know, the different regions. But let's look at some prophecy about this area. It's Isaiah chapter 9. Isaiah chapter 9. But there will be no more gloom for her who is in anguish. In earlier times, he treated the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali with contempt, but later he shall make it glorious by the way of the sea on the other side of Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles. And so the people who walk in darkness will see great light. Those who live in the dark land, the light will shine on them. So we see this prophecy about this area in Galilee. Now, if we fast forward, any guesses as to what we're alluding to if we fast forward? Having, I guess, Matthew reference up there kind of gives it away, right? Matthew chapter 4, if we look at Matthew chapter 4, verses 12 through 17, what are we seeing here? Matthew chapter 4, 12 through 17. Now when Jesus heard that John had been taken into custody, he withdrew into Galilee. And leaving Nazareth, he came and settled in Capernaum, which is by the sea, or by the Sea of Galilee, in the region of Zebulun and Naphtali. This is to fulfill what was spoken through Isaiah the prophet: the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, by the way of the sea, beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles. The people who were sitting in darkness saw a great light, and those who were sitting in the land of and shadow of death, upon them a light dawned. From that time, Jesus began to preach and say, "The repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand." The area of Galilee was a major part in the early ministry of Jesus, and we see that here in this context and the prophecy that was fulfilled about this area. And so Jesus spent a lot of time around this lake, and also this area had, this particular lake, this body of water had various names prior to Sea of Galilee. I guess the word sea is sort of a misnomer because it's really not that big. It's like 18 miles at its longest and 7 miles wide at its widest. How many of you know the dimensions of Lake Okeechobee? 60
miles.
Wide? 60? Oh, okay. So Okeechobee is a little bit bigger than the Sea of Galilee, right? So the sea is sort of a misnomer. It's more of like, that's a nice lake, right? But there's a lot that takes place. Remember we talked about the topography of that area, and that the Sea of Galilee, or this nice little lake, was much lower than the surrounding land, the mountains that were around it, which caused what? What did that, just that difference in elevation, what did that happen? What happened on this lake in the evenings, particularly? Do you remember? the disciples got caught in this from time to time. Strong storms, right? They would come down, especially in the evenings when things were cooling off, which we, what's interesting that would happen, because we lived in a canyon when I was growing up for a few years, and the walls of the canyon were all black basalt rock, and it was a deep canyon, and in the morning, the wind would blow up the canyon as things were starting to warm up, but in the evening, when it was much warmer, that cold air would come down and the hot air was rising, it would get a very windy going the opposite direction. So it's interesting how the topography of a land will change just even what's going on around you at that time. So that happened with the disciples quite a bit. But should they have been surprised? Some of the disciples were what? Jesus called from some of his disciples from around the shore there in Galilee. What were they by trade? Fishermen. Fishermen typically know weather, right? Some of you are fishermen, and you typically don't even go out sometimes if the clouds are not the way they're supposed to be. And so in this, they should have known, but it happens from time to time. And so even that played a part in a lot of the things that took place with Jesus and his disciples. We can think of several instances where he calmed the storm and Peter walked on the water, which, how many of you would have stepped out of the boat? Okay, so anyway, so we see those kind of things taking place because of the topography, because of the land, the things that are going on there. So that's quite interesting. And the last thing I want to look at is this what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 26. Matthew chapter 26, verse 32. I'll start in verse 31. Then Jesus said to them, "You will all fall away because of me this night, for it is written, I will strike down the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock shall be scattered. But after I have been raised, I will go ahead of you to Galilee." What is Jesus talking about? He's talking about, I'm about to die. When I have been raised, I will go ahead of you to Galilee. Not only am I will be raised on the third day, he's been telling them that, and you know they're not quite grasping it. Even now, Peter's like, no. And I will go ahead of you to Galilee. He already set up a meeting place to meet with them in that time. And it's apparent that they needed a reminder. If you look over a few pages in chapter 28, verses 6 through 10, we'll begin in verse 5, I guess, to get the context. "The angel said to the women, 'Do not be afraid, for I know that you are looking for Jesus who has been crucified. He is not here, for he is risen. Just as he said, come and see the place where he was laying. Go quickly and tell his disciples that he is risen from the dead. And behold, he is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him. Behold, I have told you.'" Here's a message I'm supposed to give to you. End of message is, you know, this the angel. "And they left the tomb quickly and fear with fear and great joy and ran to report to the disciples. And behold, Jesus met them and greeted them. And they came up and took hold of his feet and worshipped him. Jesus said to him, 'Do not be afraid. Go and take word to my brethren to leave for Galilee, and there they will see me.'" So it wasn't only enough that an angel said this to those who were there, but Jesus needed to remind them, make sure you tell them to meet me in Galilee. And we read in the end of John that took place. Jesus or Peter said what? "I'm going fishing." You know, they're waiting around. "I'm going fishing," which is fine to do. I approve of that message. And he goes fishing with some of the disciples, and they're out there fishing, and that you would think they would have remembered. "Did you catch anything?" There's this figure on the shore. "Did you catch anything?" "No, cast the nets on the other side," and they catch all the fish. And that's when the light comes on to Peter. "It's the Lord," you know, or John rather. "It's the Lord." And Peter, which by the way, just for you know, you need to be clothed when you swim, because Peter put on his clothing and jumped into the water. It's biblical. And swam to meet Jesus. And Jesus was waiting there with some fish, and they ate together in Galilee. So a lot takes place in that region, a lot obviously. But it's interesting that before Jesus even had died, "Meet me, I go before you in Galilee." What's interesting for us is our Galilee is where? "I go before you, I wait for you in heaven. I prepared a place for you. I'm waiting for you there." So lastly, we're going to look at, in your classes, Jerusalem, and in There's a lot, obviously, that takes place in Jerusalem. But you see, what's interesting about this picture, this is not the Jerusalem that David knew. This is not the Jerusalem that Solomon knew. This is Jerusalem during the time of Christ. And you see the different additions that have taken place over the years. And then the Herodian temple here in this big complex. And just the walls that have taken place over time. Also, what's important to note about Jerusalem are these valleys. And you see here Mount of Olives and Mount of Olives and the Kidron Valley. So they're going across this valley. The different pools that we read about and different gates. And so this is, it's neat to see. How many of you have read a book and had to go back and refer to maps as you're reading a book? Anybody read Tolkien ever? Nobody? Okay, just me? Okay. So a lot of times when you're reading some books, you have to go back and reference a map. And it's great to see that in the context of how far are they traveling? What are they doing while they're doing these things? And so Jerusalem, its ancient name is Salem. We see about that in Genesis chapter 14 when Abraham met Melchizedek. And then we see that again affirmed in Psalm 76. Abraham made an offering in this place called Mount Moriah. What offering did he think he was going to make, and what offering did he end up making? He thought he was going to be offering Isaac, right? They ended up offering a ram. Isaac was appreciative of that. But we see a lot of history unfolds in this place. A lot of history unfolds in this place. Because so God asked and he showed. Abraham didn't just pick a mountain. There were a lot of mountains around Abraham. He could have just picked, oh, there's a good mountain. Let's just go there. And we'll make, that's a good mountain. And there were even higher mountains if height was the issue. But God specifically showed him this mountain. Go to this place and offer your son Isaac. What offering of a child, a son, took place thousands of years later on this same spot or this same area? Jesus. Will they be able to do it? Will they obey me enough to even offer their son when I will be offering my son in the same area years later? I think that tie is really rather interesting. But later on, obviously, a temple is built by Solomon. David is the one who wants to build the temple, a man after God's own heart, but he's not able to. He's not able to be the one to build the temple because he's a man of war, and it's Solomon that actually builds the temple. David prepares all the goods, gets everything ready, puts all the Lego pieces together so that whenever Solomon comes into play, he can actually build that temple. What's also interesting, as we were mentioning earlier, that there were still people living, the Jebusites were still living in this area, this city, this fortified city, up until David, after David killed Goliath. David's the one that kind of finally came in and just routed everybody, got them all out of there. And so there are a lot of places that were like that, that not until times later did they actually get all the descent or the inhabitants out of that area. Then we have the events of the life of Jesus and the different things that took place there. And then let's look at Micah chapter 4 in connection to a prophecy with this area. Micah chapter 4. Micah chapter 4, verses 1 through 3. And it'll come about in the last days that the mountain of the house of the Lord will be established as a chief of the mountains. It'll be raised above the hills, and the peoples will stream into it. Many nations will come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord and to the house of God of Jacob, that he may teach us about his ways, and we may walk in his paths. For from Zion will go forth the law, even the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. And he will judge between many peoples and render decisions for mighty distant nations, and they will hammer their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not lift up sword against nation, and never war again will they train for war. So here in this prophecy about this particular city, where do we read the fulfillment of that prophecy? When is this message preached forth from Jerusalem? When have all nations come to that area? Day of Pentecost. That message goes forth from that city. So this is obviously a rather important city. Even today, it's still an important city for some people, but this is where it began, and this is where the church started as well. So these are the areas we're going to be looking at, and we're discovering Bible lands. You will have classes on these particular areas, and your teacher will go into much more detail about different aspects of these areas. But this is what we're going to be talking about in discovering Bible lands and seeing how these different places shape and molded what was happening, what took place in the Bible. Just real quick as we close, I didn't even put that up there for you, sorry. Let's go ahead and get all these up there. Vacation Bible School, why do we do this? Why do we do this? It's fun, I understand, to wrap a room in paper. I gotcha. I mean, that's pretty fun. It's also fun to build this random-looking temple thing. That's fun, right? But why do we do Vacation Bible School? It's time for more instruction, right? And it's a great time to teach the kids in a different way. If I had had classes where we had transformed a room, where you stepped into the temple, that would have been really, really cool. Although we did have awesome, we had red fruit juice when I was growing up, which we can't have here. So that's one thing I had that you can't have here. But another thing is an opportunity to invite friends. So VBS is not just about education. It's also a time where we can invite friends and invite our neighbors, even neighbors' kids. Well, you know, kids are what right now? Sitting around with nothing to do, right? Telling parents, I'm bored, and come to VBS, right? Which, by the way, parents, if you want some ideas, if your child comes to you and says they're bored, tell them, all right, I have some chores for you to do. And that cured me from telling my parents I was bored very quickly. Another opportunity is to get involved in the congregation in a different way. There's a lot of us that came together and are still going to be involved in VBS. All of us have played a part in making VBS take place. There are some of us that are interacting in ways that we hadn't interacted before. I have never sat by some of you and just folded tape into little circles. Some of you have developed great skills at folding tape into little circles so we can put paper up on the wall. Some of you developed skills in tracing you didn't even know you had. And you develop those with your brothers and sisters together as we're working together in this place to serve others. And so there's a lot of different aspects of why we do VBS, and here's a few of them. So if you're wondering why are we doing this, this is part of it. We're sharing the message, we're inviting people to come, and we're enjoying time together, and that's a win-win. So that's why we are doing VBS. Thank you very much for your time this morning. You are dismissed.